Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Annabelle Provençal. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast. Set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust, we're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Commission, Parliament, Council of Europe, European Council and European Central Bank. These are the main institutions of the EU in Brussels. But what do they do? And more importantly, how much power do they have? Alan Brown explains all. And who are the Russian oligarchs? The 16 with an inner core of 7 who asset-stripped or privatised the Russian economy back in the 1990s. We talk to Alex Kraner, author of a book on the Magnitsky Act. Dialect is produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
I'm Alan Brown, and I've been looking at the kind of structure of the EU.
Alan, what's your qualification for doing this?
Well, I've got an economics degree and that's about it, really.
But you've taken an interest in the workings of the European Union and the old common market. What was it that made you get into this?
Well, obviously, there's been lots of arguments about it, and I don't think you can form an opinion properly without just looking at legislation. There's no shortcut to that.
The thing is also, I think the mainstream press have been appalling at really explaining how the EU works. I mean, we're told it's a democratic system, but there's all sorts of questions about that. We've just had a new commission appointed, or they're in the process of appointing a commission, with the head of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde from the IMF, as actually a convicted in France for a year in prison, which she've never served for fraud. And we can say it's fraud. It's not alleged fraud because she was convicted by the courts. And also we've got this chap called Jean Michel, who's the former Prime Minister of Belgium, has just been appointed as the President of the European Commission, which is really the President of Europe. That's how they like to talk about it. So he was kicked out in Belgium. And we do see this time and time again with a lot of the senior figures in the European Union, is that the public at one stage or another have booted them out of politics. We had this with Neil Kinnock, of course, the former leader.
Mandelson as well.
Peter Mandelson. Lots of commissioners are just failed politicians. So the idea is once the public removes a politician for being so appalling that they just don't want them around anymore, and for betraying the trust, then the European Commission or the EU generally will pick them up and find a full-time job for them and a nice cosy pension. So this, of course, is not, it removes the incentive for politicians to actually do what they say they'll do. So getting back to explaining how the European Union works, can you just take us through the main institutions and how they work together?
The central body is the European Council, which is essentially the heads of state or the heads of government, depending of its member governments. And they
either prime ministers or presidents?
Yes. And they meet twice a year mainly, and they set the overall direction of where they want the EU to go. They also have a central role in appointing the presidents of the various EU bodies. It's supposed to be under taking account of the results of the European election, but this time they took no notice of it at all and just went ahead.
Okay, so that's the Council of Europe. Yeah. You're saying it's the central body, but some people say the Commission is more powerful.
Well, they set their overall direction, but the right of initiative for legislation exists with the European Commission.
Okay, so in the past it was Juncker, Jean-Claude Juncker and Donald Tusk. They were the presidents of these two bodies. Which of the two is really the most powerful? Because the president of the EU Commission, not the Council of Europe, is talked about as the president of Europe.
I would say that the European Commission on a day-to-day basis is more important, because they not only have the exclusive right of initiation of legislation, they also monitor countries' compliance with EU legislation, i.e. state aid rules and the fiscal compact.
There's a lot of power there, isn't it? Because yes. they can monitor closely or they can turn the other way.
They can also impose massive fines, up to 0.5% of GDP.
Now, you know what I'm thinking? Is the relationship between the Council of Europe and the European Commission is a little bit like a board and the executive board, the people who are full-time employees yes. working every day, who are supposed to be overseen by a board, but then that board doesn't necessarily know what's going on. They have to trust the executive to tell them what's happening. So there is a... If the European Commission hold their cards close to their chest, it's very difficult for the Council of Europe to be making informed decisions. And of course, they are very good at putting forward things with their own spin. So, what about the European Council? So we've heard about a bit about the Commission, which is a kind of civil service, which is considered the government of Europe, the president of Europe. Hang on, before we do, this isn't it a bit upside down about this? Because many people say, well, the European Commission being in charge isn't right because they are supposed to be civil servants. They're supposed to be doing what the politicians tell them, not the other way around. We've got the politicians at the European Parliament, the MEPs, pretty much being told what to do by the civil servants at the Commission. Is that accurate or not?
I would say yes, but it goes further than that. Is that people describe the European Commission as civil service. They're not, because... the civil service in the UK do not have the right to initiate legislation. They support the legislature. They don't initiate. Also, the other problem is that the way they're appointed is also problematic, in as much as the way that they're appointed by the European Council, but individual commissioners are suggested by member governments, but these can be blocked by the president of the European Commission. And they're voted on en masse by the Parliament. So this is not really a kind of transparent procedure.
Okay, so we've got the European Parliament, which is the MEPs, elected back in May. We've also got the Council of Europe, the heads of state, getting together. We've also got the European Commission, which is the government of Europe, or the civil service, depending on how you look at it. These failed politicians, most of them, who are given the job of running the European Union in initiating legislation. What about the most recent tranche of people? So we mentioned Jean Michel, the former Prime Minister of Belgium, who was removed by his own country back in December last year because he's much more enthusiastic about mass migration into Belgium than the politicians in Belgium want. So there's him. There's Christine Lagarde being put in charge of the European Central Bank. There's also Ursula von der Leyen. She yes. is going to be
former defence minister.
One of the most powerful people. That is to say, chairing the Council of Europe. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that for countries within the Eurozone, the most powerful body is still the European Central Bank, because they supply liquidity to private banks and they also control monetary policy.
So Ursula von der Leyen is head of the European Commission, and Jean Michel is going to be the president of the Council of Europe. So these are the two main positions, but I mean, these people are basically compromised and they're appointees. There is usually some sort of discussion with the European Parliament about these appointments.
Do you have the preferred, what they brought in was the preferred candidate?
The Spitzenkandidat.
Yes. Is essentially, you have the European elections and Europe is sort of divided up into main kind of political groups, and each political group proposes a candidate, and depending on the results of the EU election, that is supposed to be the preferred candidate, the one that wins the largest share. But this hasn't happened here.
So they've just ignored what the yes. MEPs have said. Have the MEPs kicked back at all and said, hang on a minute, what are you doing?
If they have done, they've been very quiet about it.
Yeah. Okay. So Ursula von der Leyen is an interesting character. She's been defence minister in Germany for many years now, and one of her main missions has been in charge of, certainly a part of the European Council, has been the EU army. and military integration has been one of her portfolios, and she's been one of the main people spearheading it. She's also very close to Henry Kissinger as well, war criminal and former Secretary of State in the United States. But there are other, I mean, I think it's useful to just look at the trajectory of the European Union and the common market over the years, because this is the thing I think which has irritated quite a lot of people, is that we joined this thing back in the 1970s, 1973?
Yes.
And that was the common market. It's since changed to become something very different, the EU. That was the Maastricht Treaty. And now, since then, we've also had something called the Lisbon Treaty, which has changed it again. But because they're treaties, this has not been voted on in a referendum of any sort, although it has been voted in Holland, in Denmark, I think, and in Ireland and France. So how does that work? When there's a big change in the EU, how come some countries will have a vote about it, a national vote, a referendum, and some won't?
That will depend on their individual constitution. For instance, Ireland did have a referendum just on the Lisbon Treaty. They rejected it for it only to be reintroduced a year later for it to pass. So there's been long-standing attempts to kind of circumvent sort of process.
So this is really similar to this, what they call people's vote here.
Yes.
So we voted against or to leave the European Union. And as many people who are pro-EU have just campaigned to have another vote, and literally to keep voting until we get the right result that they want.
This has happened twice in Ireland. There was the Treaty of Nice as well. They rejected it initially as well.
And also the French and the Dutch also voted on a previous version of the Lisbon Treaty. And this is another thing, isn't it? So they voted against that, but it was reintroduced with a different name.
Yeah, because in the EU constitution.
So how did that work, and when did that happen?
Well, the EU constitution, the votes for the in Holland and France for the EU constitution happened in 2005. Then it was. The Lisbon Treaty, as a treaty, was finally signed off in 2009. So they just reintroduce it as a treaty.
Okay, so one is the constitution, yes. Which is being a little bit more honest,
yes.
About what it is, and the
yes.
Second is a treaty.
Yes.
And yet very few countries actually had a referendum on the treaty.
Only Ireland did, which they ignored. It would depend on the constitution of the individual countries.
You know what I'm thinking here is that most treaties are negotiated by governments, aren't they?
Yes.
So if they can call it a treaty, then the constitution doesn't have to be voted on by the people. So they can change the whole of what happens in the European Union by having a treaty and not a constitutional change, even yes. though the treaty is a constitutional change. All right, so having cleared that up a little bit, so we've got joining the common market back in 1973. We've then got, hang on, no, because it was 75, wasn't it? We joined in 73, but we only had a referendum in 75.
Referendum in 75.
Which confirmed our membership.
Yes.
Okay. So that happened in 1975. Then the next big change was Maastricht in 1993. Now, this is the treaty that Margaret Thatcher refused to sign. What was Maastricht?
Well, Maastricht was essentially setting the framework and the organisation for ever closer union to be able to launch the single currency and create the Eurozone. This was to set, you get qualified majority voting, they limit the ability, they tighten the budgetary constraints, the convergence
okay,
criteria.
Okay, so just a minute, because this is... Okay, so you've got two things there. This different type of voting, qualified majority voting. What's that?
Well, what we have at the moment with the EU is an ordinary legislative procedure. EU Commission proposes legislation. This is co-decided by the Council of Ministers and the European Parliament. The Council of Ministers vote qualified majority voting, or you can have a blocking minority. In the European Council, it's a simple majority. Before, you had things like unanimity.
What's the difference?
Say you'd have to have, say, a 66% kind of vote for it.
Okay, so more than 50%.
Yes, more than 50%. It's a qualified majority.
Well, what about the veto? Whatever happened to that? Because we keep hearing, don't we, that actually, oh, well, everybody's got a veto in the EU. Things can only happen if everyone agrees.
That's just not true. It's very complicated. What you had with the councillors, ministers, is that with unanimity, i.e. everybody has to vote for it to pass, but with qualified majority, individual governments can't block. So,
okay, so when did that change happen then?
Well, you still have unanimity for some bits of legislation. Oh,
okay, so it depends what you're voting about,
yes,
as to what type of vote you have.
What happened in Lisbon is they very much narrowed what would be unanimity. In unanimity, only the Council of Ministers decides, the European Parliament is only advisory.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound like the European Parliament is kind of just watching on while everyone else in these other institutions makes all the decisions. So are there still any veto issues? If, say, for example, there was to be decisions about a European army made by Ursula von der Leyen, and the European Commission, would there be everyone be able to veto it?
It would depend on how the legislation was framed.
Maybe they could frame it as some kind of civil legislation and not military legislation, and then it would be okay.
Well, so after your co-decision and both kind of, you know, legislative bodies decide to pass legislation, it's supposed to go for ratification to member governments. But the problem is, it turns on competence. If a bit of legislation is decided that it's the sole competence of the EU, individual governments cannot block it by not ratifying the legislation. But if it's of mixed competence, then for legislation to pass into EU law, then it has to be ratified by all members.
I mean, I put the question to Ken Livingstone, the former Mayor of London, now suspended. No, he's no longer a member of the Labour Party. He voluntarily left the Labour Party in order to stop a long process of investigation into him as alleged anti-Semitism. But he said that a United States of Europe could never happen because all the member states could veto it, and at least one obviously would veto.
Like I say, it depends on legislation. One could argue for Eurozone members whether or not you've already got a United States Europe. If you haven't got control of your budget, because that has to be pre-approved by the European Commission, if you haven't got control of monetary policy, because the European Central Bank has to approve the issuance of any new currency, and you're borrowing a currency which is not yours, which is produced by the European Central Bank, and your private banks are dependent on liquidity from the European Central Bank, who can turn it off and on, which they did with Ireland, if they're not following EU diktat, then I don't see how we already haven't got a United States Europe already.
What about voting, though? Do the presidents, the prime ministers, still have a veto?
On
everything?
Not on everything. Like, for instance, what is, say, sole competence of the European Union, they don't have a veto. Like, say, on, say, foreign policy, you would consider it to be the sole competence of the EU. So it doesn't have, it'll go to the...
You have no foreign policy of your own. I mean, this is like when we joined the common market, that was basically our trade policy went out the window. Most of that was then being determined by the European Union. Of course, that becomes they become much more powerful if they're also controlling your currency. You did economics. What do you make of what's happened since the introduction of the euro? When was it? 2002.
It's been a disaster. Deutsche Bank is just about to go bankrupt again. They're trying.
Well, that's a private bank, and they've been gambling as many casino banks do. That's not the euro's fault.
But the point is that the European Central Bank's monetary policy will affect Deutsche Bank. It got bailed out by the American taxpayer to the point of 0.3 billion, if you know what I mean. So interest rates and how much economic growth will obviously affect private banks.
So what has been the problem with the euro then? Why is countries like Italy and Greece complaining constantly they want the lira back, they want the drachma back?
Essentially, you've set up a single currency without any physical transfers, i.e. not transferring money from rich areas to poor areas, which you need to do with a single currency, and you haven't pooled risk. if you've got a single currency, then you've got to borrow in a common currency, i.e. the European Central Bank has to do that borrowing. You can't have member governments borrowing a currency they can't issue. This is absurd.
So is Mark Carney in the Bank of England, are they doing a better job than Mario Draghi and now Christine Lagarde at the European Central Bank?
Only in comparison. It's like, you know, that they're doing such a bad job. Italy's banks are private banks are full of Italian government debt. They're both up to eyeballs in debt. If any of them fall over, the other one falls over. And the major exposure is the major French banks, i.e. BNP Paribas and Crédit Agricole.
So, I mean, okay, so it doesn't sound as if it's a very sound financial footing.
Yes, but also the problem is that if they had their own currency, then the Italian Central Bank could issue, create electronic money and monetize that debt or supply unlimited liquidity to private banks. But they're dependent on European Central Bank to do that.
Wow, okay. So you say that the United States of Europe's already happened. Has there not really been an announcement about this, though, has there? Although Merkel and Macron both seem to be fans of the idea.
Well, I mean, what is the point of voting if you can't vote on your member government, your government's budget and how much it interferes in the market through state aid, and you haven't got control of the monetary policy? Obviously, it's less of a problem in the UK because we at least are not part of the euro.
Okay, so money and finance is a bit of a dark art. Don't you think it needs a little bit better explaining by our financial media and by the mass media generally?
Yes, but the problem with the EU is, even compared to, say, parliamentary procedure in the America or the UK, it has almost been made intentionally ridiculously complicated. So it's difficult to hold to account because it's so opaque.
Well, there is a book called Debunking Economics by Steve Keen. Are there any other books that you'd recommend?
What Corporate Watch have got their free PDF download, Corporate Watch, False Dilemmas, A Critical Guide to the Eurozone Crisis.
And what's in that? Give us a brief praise.
Well, it does the structure and the economics behind the EU and also the history about how these economic crises happened and haven't been resolved.
What conclusions do they come to, Corporate Watch, and who are they?
Well, they do lots of interesting kind of investigative reporters, and the UK based essentially, and they seem to just try to make things a bit more transparent, if you know what I mean.
And there's also a Greek economist who was part of Syriza, but he got disillusioned, as so many other people did, including Varoufakis. Because they basically didn't do what they were elected to do. And, of course, we've just had a Greek government booted out. Syriza have been booted out, and the right wing are now in Greece. So who's he, and what's his book?
Kostas Levistas, and his book is The Left Case Against the EU.
OK, so Left Case for Brexit is the book. Kostas Lapavitsas, now I'll spell that, C-O-S as in Costa Coffee, C-O-S-T-A-S, with an S on the end, now sold by Whitbread to Coca-Cola, I think that Costa has been. But anyway, Kostas Lapavitsas, L-A-P-A-V-I-T-S-A-S, well worth tracking down. Alan Brown, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Alex Craner. I'm a commodity trader and a hedge fund manager based in Monaco. I'm a Croatian by nationality, and I've lived in Monaco for the past 23 years. I've written two books, one on commodities trading and one is on Bill Browder and the Magnitsky Act and the anti-Russian sanctions.
Okay, well, first of all, you're from Croatia. Can you give us your take? Because I think there's a lot of people in the Western world who are a bit mystified about the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. Give us your take on what happened there.
What, during the 1990s?
Yeah.
Well, you know, kind of like Russia, we were a socialist country. The former Yugoslavia was a socialist country ruled by a single communist party, let's call it dictatorship. It was kind of soft, but basically the socialist economy was unsustainable. It was going down the toilet. The monetary system came apart. The situation became more and more difficult.
Well, I mean, you as someone that's involved in the financial services industry, are in a better position than most of us to explain what happened there, why the Yugoslav economy tanked. Was it just bad leadership?
No. It wasn't bad leadership. The leadership was bad. The country was corrupt. There's no question about that. But it wasn't, you know, like it was corrupt on a small scale compared to what it is today. So today we have, again, corruption, but on a different scale and a much larger scale. So it wasn't about corruption. It's basically the monetary system, which has the seeds of doom built in. And it's inevitable. Basically, all the money that goes into circulation in any given economy is based on debt. It was, you know, the same exact fractional reserve banking where the money goes into circulation as debt that has to be paid back in interest, except interest is never put into circulation. So the only way to grow it is essentially a Ponzi scheme where people have to take on more debt in order to make the system flow. Except, you know, as debt builds up beyond the economy's capacity to repay it, then the system starts grinding to a halt. You start losing liquidity. The companies start going bankrupt. Unemployment goes up. And then, you know, the political establishment has to pump money back into the system. And the only way they can do it is by raising more debt, by printing more money. And eventually that leads to hyperinflation, which is what we had. So the whole system kind of collapsed into a major episode of stagflation. And so the situation was very unsatisfactory to everybody in the country. And so we sought, the separate republics of the former Yugoslavia sought to go out, to reorganize the country as a confederation. The Belgrade authorities wanted to keep it centralized. Initially, the Western powers, the United States, Britain, and Western Europe, supported centralized Yugoslavia as the Belgrade authorities wanted to keep it. And then there was an armed conflict. And I think the armed conflict was entirely avoidable, but I think ultimately it became in the interest of certain foreign powers to have this war happen. To divide the country into smaller entities and to make these entities their client states. I personally am convinced that all the stories about ancient hatreds and all this is complete nonsense. You know, I'm a child of a mixed marriage. My mother is Serbian, my father is Croatian. There's a lot of intermingling, cultural, political, family.
So, okay, I mean, you know, as someone that manages finances now, what do you make of how Yugoslavia was run, say, for example, in the 1970s and the 1980s? Was it a potentially good economy? Was it something that was working for Yugoslavians?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, it was. Let's say that the general population back then was much, much better off than they are today, okay?
Well, I mean, you might say the same for the United States. And what I'm trying to say is, you know, was it a sustainable, or was it, you know, were they having a good time in the 1970s and 1980s and paying for that in the 90s?
Yeah, that's true. That is true. That is true. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, the economy was doing well. The people were relatively prosperous. There wasn't all that much debt in the system. And even though we were less prosperous than our counterparts in the West, we had money to spend. You know, even back in the 80s and in the 70s, I, as a child, my parents would take us for every winter skiing to Italy or to Austria. You know, and that was not just us. That was, you know, like a whole group of families together with kids would make a 1 week trip to some ski resorts in Austria and or Italy. And this was a thing. we had money for vacations, we had spending money for nice clothes and all that. We didn't buy, you know, like we didn't drive Ferraris and Mercedeses and didn't have large McMansions with swimming pools and jacuzzis. But people were comfortable, and the economy was a fairly well diversified consumer economy where you had, you know, like you had most everything that you needed to acquire.
I mean, it sounds to me as if, you know, your basic costs aren't too much and you've got a fair amount of disposable income. That's what we all aspire to now.
Yes, exactly. But we don't have that because everybody's in debt up to their eyeballs and they're working frantically to not go bankrupt. The tax burdens, the interest rate burdens, all of these things are now much, 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 much heavier. We have austerity where all the things that are actually useful to societies are getting defunded. So the functioning of the post office, of the utilities, of the healthcare system, of the policing, everything has deteriorated very visibly. We're becoming one of those third world countries where everything that the tourist sees is beautiful and wonderful and glitzy. But the you know, like where ordinary people live and make their living is allowed to run down and being defunded and let to itself.
I mean, there's some people that say that countries like Yugoslavia under Tito and Libya under Gaddafi were actually very successful, and that the IMF and the Western powers, the NATO powers, decided that these examples had to be gotten rid of, otherwise they would show up how bad much of the and corrupt much of the West in the City of London, Wall Street and that lot are.
I think those arguments are not without merit, definitely. You know, there's some truth in that. Now, I have to say that the system as it was in the former Yugoslavia was, you know, people were not satisfied. People wanted a different system, a better life and so forth. But I think that in part that has to do also with how people perceive the prosperity on the other side of the fence, you know? And so, you know, even though we had everything we needed, life wasn't, you know, like we didn't live in great luxury, but we lived in adequate comfort. And let's say that the social side of life was very satisfying. I do remember when I was a teenager going out with my friends that we would actually on numerous occasions, we would actually think like, dude, aren't we lucky to be living in this place at this time? Isn't this awesome? And we really felt that life was good.
Okay, so, you know, there was a big difference, though, between Tito's Yugoslavia and, not Stalin at that point, but, you know, Brezhnev, etc.'s Russia, and even Gorbachev's Russia. The seeds were being sown, I know, in those days for problems with the Soviet Union. What do you make of how the Russian oligarchs that were really, I suppose, tearing Russia apart in the 1990s, really taking their assets and, you know, for very, very low prices and for their own personal property and then making fortunes from them? How did those oligarchs, you know, where did they come from and how come they were all, they all seem to be working in parallel?
Well, the Russian oligarchs were, most of them were children of Communist Party rulers. My understanding is that they were all recruited from the Komsomol, which was the organization of communist youth, communist political youth organization in Russia. And basically they were funded. They were given money when nobody had money. Okay, so the Russian economy was crashed deliberately by through the advice of Western shock therapy advisors.
Well, what year are we talking about here? You mean it's 1990?
Yeah, we're talking 1990s. But this the groundwork was laid even before that. Because during Gorbachev's time, some banking reforms were enacted so that foreign capital could come in and set up private banks. So the, you know, like the network started to be put in place before the actual transition. And then when the transition started to happen in earnest under Yeltsin, then the Russian economy was simply demolished. The price controls were removed overnight, and inflation shot up 500%. The liquidity was drastically drained. So we know that the Russian economy after these reforms got enacted was functioning at something like 16% of the money mass that the economy of its size required. So what happened is that nobody had any money. Companies didn't have money to pay their employees or to pay their bills or to acquire the goods to run their business. People were not receiving salary, police, military, nobody was getting any money. People were being paid in kind. So if you worked in a clothes store, in a clothes factory, they would just give you, you know, jackets and pants and socks. And if you worked in a food store, a food company, they would give you pasta and cans of meat.
Well, so this is a kind of barter system developing.
Yeah, because there was no money to pay people. There's just like simply no cash. And so what people had to do after work, they had to take this to pawn it off in the street and to exchange it for things that they needed. Okay. And so in this environment, people were very, very busy just making sure that they survive, and that wasn't easy. And then, so in this environment, the privatization of Russia's state companies took place. Nobody had any money to buy these shares. And when the so-called voucher privatization took place, and these 10,000 ruble vouchers were distributed to all the Russian people, they had no idea what to do with them, but they knew that they needed food. And so what happened is that all these voucher agents went around Russia and collected vouchers from the people for sausages, for bottles of vodka, for essentially nothing. And then they turned around and they acquired the stock shares of these of the best of the best of Russia's economy. For essentially nothing.
Okay, so there were quite a lot of people doing that. They're known as the oligarchs. How many roughly oligarchs were there, and where did they come from? So are they actually Russian nationals?
Yeah. Most of them were Russian nationals. They were Russian, but they were backed with foreign money, and each one of them had you know somebody like the Rothschilds or George Soros or somebody like that attached to them. And we know that because when Mikhail Khodorkovsky was thrown in prison, then it came out, and this was an article in the London Times, which had been scrubbed since, but apparently there was a contract with an unknown entity that if he became incapacitated, the controlling shares of Yukos would pass over to one of the Rothschilds.
Okay, what was Yukos? What company? What does it represent?
Yukos was, I think at the time, largest or second largest Russian oil company, which Mikhail Khodorkovsky acquired for some very, very small sum of money because he controlled the Menatep Bank, which was also a Rothschild-controlled bank. And Menatep Bank was able to acquire this because they were running the auction where Yukos was being sold, and they also were receiving there were also how do you call it transacting certain state monies like monies for the pensions, money for the Academy of Sciences, and so forth. So with these monies that were coming in from the state, they were able to buy the shares of Yukos. And then for a period of time, the people, like I think it was the Russian Academy of Science, for several months, they were not receiving any salaries because the money that they were supposed to receive apparently were used to acquire the shares of Yukos by Mikhail Khodorkovsky. So I think that these young men were recruited basically for ambition and for lack of scruple.
So roughly how many oligarchs were there? And you know, and have you got any evidence that they were trained in parallel?
Yeah, I think there were like the big ones were 16, and out of those 16, I think the really big ones were, I think, 7, because they had even the name Semibankirshchina, which means the rule of 7 bankers. And so this was Berezovsky, Gusinski, Khodorkovsky. I don't know all the names off the top of my head, but there was like seven big guys.
Well, another one of these oligarchs has kind of come to prominence again, Kolomoisky, because of his interest in Ukraine. Yeah. I mean, he's actually, you know, of course, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, and he is the sponsor of, Vladimir, I can't remember his name, the new president of Ukraine, Zelensky.
Yes, that's right. And so since Zelensky came to power, he got his bank back.
Okay, so the other one, which is very, very well known, famous, I mean, we mentioned Khodorkovsky, Kolomoisky, Berezovsky, and some more. But Berezovsky is one of the curious ones. And then some people talked about him as the king of the oligarchs. Why did they do that? Is that justified?
Well, at the time, he was the biggest and most powerful one, and he was the closest to the seat of power in the Kremlin. He was nonstop around Boris Yeltsin and his various prime ministers like Chernomyrdin and Anatoly Chubais. And he was basically running the show from behind the scenes.
You've mentioned Soros, you've mentioned Rothschild, you've mentioned many of these are Jewish people. In fact, almost all the oligarchs were Jewish. What do you say to those who would accuse you of saying, well, you know, what you're coming out with here is anti-Semitic?
Well, people would say that it's anti-Semitic. I think, you know, these are not, they happen to be Jewish, not all of them. They happen to be Jewish by their family background. But regardless, you know, whether they were Jewish or not Jewish, the result is the same. And I know that many of them are not actually religious Jews. They were atheists. So,
Well, I think you might find that none of them were religious, actually.
I find the accusation of anti-Semitism, I reject it entirely. I think it's just a deflection, and it's a disingenuous attempt to defend criminal acts behind something that's racist and ugly. I'm very, very far away from being anti-Semitic, but I'm also not about to defend crime because some people who are involved happen to be Jewish.
Okay, well, look, Berezovsky and Khodorkovsky certainly both were victims or whatever of prosecutions over in Russia, and they were criminals. But surely the rest of the oligarchs were simply businessmen who were, you know, making a buck, which is what businessmen are supposed to do. They weren't criminals.
It's in the way that they acquired something like 70% of Russia's economy. That was criminal. Well, you know, technically, maybe it wasn't even criminal because the whole legal system went into disarray where Boris Yeltsin essentially ruled by decree, and his decrees were written by these advisors who were sent in by Western nations. So Boris Yeltsin was ruling by decree, and his decrees were essentially crafted and written by this whole panoply of Western advisors who came from the United States, from Sweden, from Germany, from France, from the UK, and so forth. And the whole point of the whole affair was to plunder the wealth of Russian economy.
Now, what about the attempts by Russians now, including Putin, to get some of this wealth back?
Well, I think that the Russians are working on trying to get this back, but I think that their efforts are being thwarted by these Magnitsky legislation that's being enacted in all the key Western nations.
Now, Magnitsky is a word we hear from time to time on the news. Can you explain why it's called Magnitsky and what is this all about?
Well, this is a story that's put together by one Bill Browder, who used to run the largest foreign-owned hedge fund in Russia called Hermitage Capital Management. Bill Browder is the author of Red Notice, which has become something of a supposedly bestseller, although I don't know. And the whole story is about how he got thrown out of Russia because he was supposedly politically persecuted. His supposed lawyer, who wasn't a lawyer but an accountant, Sergei Magnitsky, discovered massive fraud perpetrated by corrupt Russian police, and he blew the whistle on this. And then supposedly these corrupt Russian policemen arrested Magnitsky and threw him in jail, and within a year of him being in jail, he died, supposedly murdered by these same corrupt police officers in order to cover up their tracks. Well, there's all kinds of problems with this story. But the point of Magnitsky Act is that, like, Magnitsky Act, the first one passed in the United States in 2012. And then, you know, it went on in Canada and Council of Europe and so forth. And the whole point is that this is a legislation, first of all, that has been lobbied through on false premises and on a false narrative, which is very, very easy to uncover and debunk. And it foresees no due process. So basically what happens under Magnitsky legislation is that if somebody is accused of human rights abuses, they can be put on the list of sanctioned individuals, which means that they can no longer travel to the United States. Their assets in the United States and other jurisdictions can be frozen and blocked.
Well, that sounds good. I mean, nobody should be abusing human rights. That sounds quite just to me.
Well, yeah, but there should be a due process, no? If somebody accuses you of something, they have to tell you what they're accusing you of. They have to prove that you're guilty of this, and they have to give you the right to defend yourself, right? This is not the case with Magnitsky legislation. Basically, somebody from in the bowels of state bureaucracy puts you on a list, and there's no recourse, there's no due process, there's no defense, there's no proof. You're just simply on that list, which means that you can no longer travel to the United States.
Well, it sounds like, you know, reigning well back from Magna Carta. Anyway, your book is called Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder, The Magnitsky Act and Anti-Russian Sanctions, Alex. Can you tell us whereabouts we can get hold of that? Because you're going into quite a lot of depth here about the sort of the fallout from the falling of the Iron Curtain and in financial terms.
Well, yeah, I think I do think that this is one of the biggest and the least well understood stories of our lifetimes. And it still has very, very strong repercussions on political events and geopolitics today. It has very strong repercussions of the global security and on the potential of World War III developing in the near or far future. And so I think...
Well, hang on. What do you mean about World War III? Why? I mean, where's that going to happen and why would it happen?
Well, there are powers in the world that positively do want to orchestrate a World War III in some guise. Okay?
Why?
That's simply the logic. Why? For a variety of reasons, which could be said to be economic, strategic, it could be a mission. Part of it has to do with the logic of empire, and the logic of empire is that wherever there's a power that can resist your dictate, that will not submit to your power, you need to destroy them. And so today you have Russia and China, which are powerful enough to say no to the empire. You have noticed that we're in a state of permanent war already. Russia and China are being systematically surrounded, and there's an attempt to isolate them and to destabilize them. Another reason is economics. And economics, it's a complex argument, which I present in an appendix to my book, because it's, you know, like you really have to wrap your brain around the concept called the deflationary gap. And that, again, goes back to the monetary system that we have, which is a massive distortion to the economics in the West.
I mean, it seems to me what you're saying is, if we were to fix our monetary system, then actually there wouldn't be any need for this war and expansionism and empire.
Well, let's say that it would at the very least be able to remove the incentive to nonstop build the military-industrial complex, to pour a huge chunk of our economic output into the business of war. And, funding for the business of war depends on there actually being wars, and there actually being threats, and there actually being enemies. Because if there are no threats and there are no enemies, then how do you justify getting $1 trillion a year from the U.S. taxpayer for stuff that you cannot even account for? You know, like last year they've done the first ever comprehensive audit of the U.S. military, of the Pentagon, and something like $6 or $7 trillion could not be accounted for.
So if you had the top job, say whatever, head of the Federal Reserve, head of the Euro, now Christine Lagarde, if you had a head of the IMF job, what one thing would you do which would make some difference to the global economic system, do you think?
Well, I wouldn't presume that I know exactly how to solve the problem, but I would definitely study disempowering the central banks, and I would definitely study introducing secondary currencies, local, regional, time-based currencies, blockchain-based currencies, and so forth.
Why?
Because we are all forced and obliged to use the legal tender in every country. This is how we are dependent on a system over which we have absolutely no control. So somebody is creating this money at their discretion. They're allocating it to purposes that are beyond the democratic process. Who gets credit and who doesn't get credit determines how the economy of a given country is going to develop. And somebody makes those decisions. They do teach us in school that this is determined by market, that capital just kind of like gravitates towards most efficient uses and most profitable, highest returns, and blah blah blah. That's not what happens. These are discretionary decisions done by monetary mandarins about whom we know very little.
It sounds to me like you're saying that money should be much more like some kind of utility where decisions are made on merit, not on where they're friends. Is that feasible?
That's exactly the right word, Tony. Credit should be utility. Exactly. It should be utility. Not everything with the system we have today is absolutely wrong, but it does have certain distortions, which, as they percolate through the society, they affect virtually everything.
I mean, it sounds to me what you're saying is it's a little bit like, say, the police, you know, because the police have got a lot of discretion about which crime to investigate and which crime not to investigate. So the bankers have got a lot of discretion as to which loan to give and which loan not to give, because they could give a loan, say, for example, to a genetic engineering company, a massive loan, and then they say, oh dear, never mind, all the money's gone, and write it off. And yet another sort of more ethical loan might never get given in the first place. Anyway, Alex Crane, it's been fascinating talking to you again. Your book, Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder, The Magnitsky Act, and Anti-Russian Sanctions, is still available. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tony. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like. At our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Alan Brown and Alex Grainer, and to studio engineers, Dave Bazanko, Josh Chivers, and our producer, Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. I'm Annabelle Provençal and wishing you a very good week. Tony Gosling will be back on Friday with his two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Oh,